Hey, I'm Jenna Wolf, certified lactation counselor, parent coach, and extended breastfeeding mom of two. I fully understand the unique challenges of breastfeeding beyond the baby days, and I'm here to take your hand and support you along your journey. So toss that hair in a messy bun, grab a basket of laundry to fold, and let's get started. This is Start to Stop Toddler Breastfeeding. In this episode, I talk with Holly Lever, who is a she's an expert in the fertility awareness method, as well as a mom breastfeeding an almost 3-year-old. So she gets it on all fronts. She gets it. And we talk about the way that our bodies shift and change hormonally through pregnancy and the postpartum period and breastfeeding into toddler breastfeeding. We talk about alternatives to hormonal birth control when you're trying to prevent pregnancy during breastfeeding. As we know, hormonal birth control has side effects and it can impact your breastfeeding journey. We also talk about how to call in a pregnancy, how to conceive while breastfeeding, and really feel empowered in all of those areas. It's an awesome conversation. Make sure that you go and follow Holly on Instagram. Her Instagram is full of wonderful wisdom and insight. And you can grab the link to do that in the show notes. Oh, and by the way, we had a really awesome conversation before I even hit record. So I kind of hit the record button in the middle of it. So we kind of just jump right in. I didn't want to edit it out though, because Holly has some great insights and I didn't want to cut those out. But it might seem a little confusing. So just hang tight with me. You know, it'll all be good. It'll all make sense.
Yeah, I mean, so what we were talking about, because I think the recording started like after I made my comment, but I was just saying that I work with a lot of people that are wanting to get pregnant specifically. And so they're jazzed about learning fertility awareness and tracking their temperature and cervical mucus. Right. And then the baby comes and it's sort of like out the window. They just kind of forget about that. And there's so many uses in the postpartum phase is kind of what you were commenting on in assessing your health and being able to use it as birth control. And we can talk about breastfeeding in particular, if it feels relevant, because I know you mentioned that you kind of gear your podcast a little bit more towards toddler and older moms, but I did kind of want to touch on the lactational amenorrhea method, because it's kind of part of this whole thing, but it doesn't last until toddlerhood. So, so maybe I'll start from the beginning then with that. So, and one of the things I also wanted to mention is that for pregnant moms or people that are calling in a pregnancy, it could be a really good time to learn fertility awareness then, or even before you get pregnant, so that you can kind of like get all of the methods and understanding under your belt before then you have a little baby to care for.
Yeah.
But if that hasn't happened and you already have a baby, then it's not a problem, but it's just easier to navigate having almost 3-year-old of my own. It's everything before having a child is a lot easier to do. So, but it's everything it's possible to learn after as well. So say you have your baby. So the lactational amenorrhea method is kind of part of a fertility awareness method that not everybody fully aligns with, but I'll just mention it here. And so basically what it means is that if you're breastfeeding fully, which there's seven different things to consider that mean that you're breastfeeding fully. So essentially, if you are nursing on demand, not any like schedules or anything like that, not following any feeding schedules, you're just kind of like always with your baby in pretty close contact, sort of skin to skin most of the time. So this will last for the first six months, because if you are fully breastfeeding, which I'll talk about all of the seven in a little bit, that suppresses FSH and LH, which if you don't know what those are, it's okay. They're just a couple of hormones that are responsible for ovulation to happen. So there would be no way that you could get pregnant if you don't ovulate. And so because those hormones are suppressed while you're fully breastfeeding, that's why you can use this method as a method of birth control in the first 6 months only. If you don't get your cycle back in that 6 months and you are not producing any cervical mucus. So there's a little, there's so much variability. I'm sure you know this, in when women get their cycles back. And not everybody knows this, so I'll just throw it out there. You ovulate before you get your first period.
Yes.
So that is where Irish twins come from, or like, you know, people mm-hmm. kind of getting accidentally pregnant and thinking that they aren't fertile yet because they haven't had their period yet. And that is because the first period is preceded by that ovulation, and you can get pregnant if you are not assessing sort of what's going on or on some kind of birth control, like using some sort of birth control method. So to go back to what I was saying with the lactational amenorrhea method. So you're exclusively nursing day and night, no schedules, sleeping with your baby, napping with your baby, pacifying your baby and comforting at your breast. No bottles or pacifiers, and you're not really ever separate from your baby or restricting nursing in any way.
Yeah,
so
I call it the ecological breastfeeding. So you're literally your baby's ecosystem.
Yes.
You are everything to your baby.
Totally. And I just want to recognize that coming from huge, massive amounts of privilege, I was able to do that with my daughter. But I know that a lot of people, especially in the United States, have to go back to work immediately.
Right.
So this isn't possible for everybody. So nothing about what I mentioned is a judgment if you can't do that. It's just, that's just what the method is.
Yeah.
So if you are...
It's so important to make that, because a lot of people say if you're exclusively breastfeeding for the first 6 months, and then it becomes confusing. And it's like, no, it's actually not just exclusively breastfeeding. It's ecologically breastfeeding, which is a different ballgame. So it is so important, because that's when you get the idea of like, people will be like, oh, you can use breastfeeding as birth control. And then you have everybody say, no, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't. And it's like, okay, you can, but it is very specific. And I think that that's just like a very important distinction to make. So I'm so glad you brought that up.
This is why I love the podcast platform as opposed to other Instagram or whatever. It's like we need to have these nuanced conversations of like, yes. And you know, you can use breastfeeding, and there are these other things to consider. So anyway, if you kind of have already learned how to read your body and assess your cervical mucus, which I'll talk about in a little bit, prior to pregnancy, then you would probably feel a little bit more comfortable using this method for birth control. Condoms are hugely underrated, in my opinion. They are a wonderful form of birth control. So just to throw that out there. But I mean, at your 6 week appointment, for a lot of people, there is the birth control conversation. I know that there was for me, and I had a home birth with midwives, and they were not at all pushing hormonal birth control on me. They knew that I practiced the fertility awareness method and were just kind of like checking in about that. Mm-hmm. But because of that, I know that that is kind of when people start talking about it. So you know, your baby's 6 weeks old, there's a lot going on. And it would kind of make sense, just like go on the mini pill or whatever, I think is what they tend to recommend for breastfeeding moms, because there's less hormones. But there less hormones doesn't mean that there's no hormones. And synthetic hormones do impact your body in a number of ways outside of just preventing pregnancy. So I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole if you want me to, but maybe we won't.
I think that's so important. I'll have you back. You can come back every week, Holly. We'll just talk so much about this. I think that that's so important. And I was actually really grateful that I had an OB for my daughter, for my oldest. And I just said we were going to use condoms. And he was like, great. Condoms work amazing with breastfeeding. Like, that's awesome. So like, I was grateful for that. But I know that a lot of people don't even think about other alternatives. It's like, okay, I have to pick which hormonal birth control I'm going to go on. And even with the mini pill, from a breastfeeding perspective, it absolutely affects your body. And the mini pill does have less hormones, but it doesn't mean it cannot affect breast milk, because it still can, like your breast milk or your breast supply. But also that it doesn't because it has less hormones, it can still impact your body, but it also doesn't necessarily mean you won't get pregnant. It can be less effective too. So yeah. It's kind of like, there are other alternatives that I think it's important to discuss, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And I think the condom piece, I think there's a lot of resistance about it in terms of like pleasure.
Right.
So I would just invite people to be curious about other types of pleasure and sexuality, you know, like exploring 100%. Other things other than just like penis and vagina sex. I know that for me personally, like that makes a really big difference for that part of it. That if you use a condom and it's slightly less pleasurable.
I feel like we could go down a whole road about like patriarchy and everything too here, but, totally. My podcast is airing actually today on another podcast, my episode. It's called the Not Tonight podcast. So I'll give a slight plug for my friends, Rachel and Caitlin doing that. But we were all in a program together talking about like sexuality and whatnot. And really, I mean, deep diving pleasure and what that means and all of those pieces with I'm going to have my good friend, Jana Denton Howes on, who is like a huge advocate for talking about that. But I'm just so glad you mentioned that. And I think it's so important to talk about that here that we do think about like, you know, condoms as being like less pleasurable or, you know, or like we start to think about like, I don't know, we get caught up in what the sexual experience will be like with certain forms of birth control or, you know, with certain ideas. And I think that we just need to like be so open to new possibilities about what that can look like and about, you know, and like really looking at where you are at and what your situation is, because I think, I think we just have these cultural narratives that we don't question and we just like, oh, but condoms, but they're so difficult to put on beforehand. And they're, you know, like they decrease sensitivity and it's like, but okay, maybe like, you know, like, so I'm so glad you brought that up.
Well, and part of the reason that I brought it up, maybe it seems sort of confusing because I'm talking about the fertility awareness method as a potential option for birth control. But the reason I talk about condoms or potentially some other barrier methods, also the withdrawal method, which I'm another rabbit hole I could go down, that you have to do that correctly in order for it to be an accepted form of birth control. But essentially, the reason I'm bringing it up in the context of fertility awareness is because fertility awareness basically shows you or helps you to identify the times of your cycle that you're fertile and the times of your cycle that you are not. And so the postpartum phase can be a little bit confusing because as your hormones are recalibrating and breastfeeding's happening, and you can also produce arousal fluid when you're nursing. So it can be sort of like what's coming out of me, sort of confusing time, which is why in the postpartum phase, I usually recommend that's sort of a really crucial time for people to work with somebody one-on-one that can actually, they can like send them pictures of their mucus. Maybe that sounds weird, but that's a big part of my job is to help people identify what's coming out of their body, what's fertile, what's not, and when they need to protect themselves from pregnancy if they are not wanting to get pregnant.
Right.
So in general, women are fertile for 6 days out of the cycle. So it's 5 days on average of when you are producing fertile quality cervical mucus. And then ovulation day itself is what makes up that 6 days. So if you have a 28 to 32 day cycle, only 6 of those days you need to protect yourself from pregnancy.
Right.
So a lot of people don't know that. And that's why they go on birth control, because they're like, I don't want to get pregnant. And there's all of these days that I need to be avoiding pregnancy. But I think it really helps to open women's eyes. When I say 6 days, it's like those 6 days, if you want to have sex all 6 of those days, then you would just need to use some like other barrier method or withdrawal potentially during those 6 days only. But most people are not having sex that all of those days anyways.
Right.
But you might want to at some times in there around ovulation, because women's libido does tend to increase at that time. So that's just something to be aware of. So that's sort of like fertility awareness in general.
Right.
And then in the postpartum phase, there are 2 main phases. So the first phase is right after you have your baby, And then you pass what's called the lochia, which is like blood and tissue and everything that's being cleared out after the birth. So it depends on the person how long that lasts for. Right. And once that is fully gone, then you start checking for cervical mucus. And the way that you check for cervical mucus and the method that I have been trained in is to fold a piece of tissue, a piece of toilet paper flat, and then you wipe it on your vulva from front to back. And you do that every single time before and after you go to the bathroom, which sounds like sometimes people like eyes glaze over at this point. They're like, what? Like, that's so much the time. But I mean, anytime you're going to the bathroom, you're always wiping after anyways. So you're just adding in this additional time that you're wiping before just to check for cervical mucus prior to urination or having a bowel movement. And a lot of times people will forget to do the before for, you know, months, years. Sometimes it takes some time to really just like get it to be part of your practice. But essentially during this first phase, you're just checking for cervical mucus. And what you're looking for is for a point of change. So you'll do this for 3 to 4 weeks, basically, to get what we call your basic infertile pattern. And so you're basically looking for, what is my, is there any mucus that's part of my basic infertile pattern? I hope this isn't confusing. You let me know if you have.
No, I mean, I feel like I'm following super well. So essentially what you're saying is that cervix is producing a certain amount of mucus, like all the time. And so sometimes that might be a lot for some women and that's just their baseline. And then other people it's not as much. So like, so after.
Well, you, yeah. That- so not, yeah. So I'm so glad you're.
Am I hearing that properly?
Well, so the cervix is producing cervical mucus around the fertile window.
Right.
Normally, but in the postpartum phase, it's possible okay. that you're with the hormonal like recalibration and all of that, that you might notice that you have more mucus. And it's not that you're fertile every single day. Right. It's just that your body's kind of figuring it out still. Right, that's right. Why this phase is confused.
So you're kind of, you're discovering a new baseline for the postpartum where you're like, okay, exactly. I normally produce a little bit and that's normal for me.
Yes.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Okay. Exactly. And then at some point, so you do that for 3 to 4 weeks to establish what your basic infertile pattern is. And so for me personally, mine was dry. I didn't have any mucus at all. During that 3 to 4 week time where I was getting my baseline. Some women, that's the case. I just like for people to know that if you're producing some mucus at that time, you're
right.
identifying the basic infertile pattern first, and then you're looking for the point of change from then on.
Yeah.
And what that means is that your mucus will look different. So there is a whole sheet of different ways to categorize cervical mucus in the method that I've been trained in. Some methods are not this specific. I really like how specific this method is because you are never wondering what you're seeing because you are so clear about what you're looking for is the color of the mucus, the consistency, and how much it stretches every single time before and after you go to the bathroom. So you, there's never a question of like, what's happening here? I can't say that there's never a question. Sometimes things can be confusing, especially in the beginning, but And so basically you're looking for a point of change. So essentially if you normally have this like lotiony sort of looking stuff all the time, and then you notice that you shift into seeing more of this like watery lubricative, what they call this egg white consistency. Right. And in the beginning, in the postpartum phase, you might not have like the egg white that you maybe saw before pregnancy. It depends on a number of factors of sort of like your nutritional status prior to pregnancy, how the pregnancy went and how you were able to care for yourself. And then also if you're being depleted in the postpartum phase, you might notice that you have a lot less mucus than you did before. So not necessarily always looking for what you saw prior to pregnancy because you have a different body now.
So like it might,
and it could go.
Yeah. So there's some, in some benefits, it's like, oh, like just start afterwards. You're like not coming in with these preconceived ideas because your body has changed drastically. So
totally.
You can't necessarily bring that framework in with you or that frame of mind in with you.
Totally. And I mean, I will say that I think you can get back to sort of more where you were potentially, but it does take some time. So the other part of the method that I have been trained in is to track your basal body temperature. Yes. But in this first phase, it's typically not recommended to take your temperature because it's super unreliable at this time.
Gotcha.
It's so hard to go back to that newborn phase, but I'm like, yeah, my daughter woke up every 2 hours for, I don't know, the first 3 months or something.
Yeah.
So I was not tracking my temperature at all because it, in order to get an accurate BBT reading, you need 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep. And I mean, that's just a guideline. And most new moms are not getting that. So at this 3 month mark, potentially when your child is sleeping, more consistently, sleeping through the night, I don't know. I mean, my daughter still kind of wakes up sometimes. So
yeah, cause you're going to hit that, like you're going to hit the sleep regressions potentially at 4 and, and 9-ish months, right? Like, so you're going to have these windows of time where things kind of go a little bit sideways.
And if they're sick or whatever, then they're wanting to nurse sort of all night long and you're just sort of worrying. So basically you can introduce tracking your temperature after you start seeing cervical mucus is sort of the general recommendation. Or, but the other thing that you can use BBT for outside of tracking when you ovulate is to identify any issues with your metabolism. Mm. So I do like for people to do it kind of whenever they're able to. And there are wearable devices like the Temp Drop, for example. But what I found with the Temp Drop, because that's what I was using earlier on before I could start doing the manual again, because I kind of just wanted to see what I would find. And my temperature was really quite low using the Temp Drop, which is, it goes underneath your armpit, which is technically an accepted form of tracking BBT. But for me, it was way lower because then I started, I was like, you know, my temperatures have never been this low. And I don't think I have, I feel kind of fine. I don't really think I have an issue. And so then I started doing, taking my temperature orally as well. And my temperatures were totally fine. So just know that for assessing metabolism, really doing the oral temperature is the best. And holding it in your mouth for 10 minutes before you take the reading is the recommendation to get the most
accurate. It's a long time when you're chasing little kids around.
Well, what I personally do is, well, and it's gone through stages as my daughter's gotten older, but I would just, I sleep with her, I co-sleep. So if you're doing that, then you basically just have the thermometer right next to your bed, put it in your mouth and just lay there and try not to wake up the child. And then you push the button and like sometimes the beeping would wake her up and sometimes it wouldn't or whatever. And some days I would forget, you know, if she was sick or, you know, we had a really wacky night of sleep or whatever, then I just let it go for that day. It's like not the end of the world. What you're looking for with all of this stuff is a pattern. And so you're not any one individual data point doesn't matter outside of the context of the full chart. So if you miss a day or two, or if you have really crappy sleep, you can still write the temperature down, but then just kind of ignore it as you're assessing your overall chart. So anyway, that's the first phase is tracking cervical mucus, looking for this point of change after you've established your basic infertile pattern in that first 3 to 4 weeks after the lochia stops.
Right.
That's a lot of points. And then phase two is after you have your first true period. And the reason that I call it a true period is because it's not a period. A bleed from your vagina is not necessarily a period unless it's been preceded by ovulation. So anovulatory bleeds are very common in the postpartum phase because as your hormones are sort of figuring themselves out again, sometimes you have enough estrogen to build up the endometrial lining, but you don't have enough progesterone or like this FSH LH cascade of events, it doesn't fully happen. So then your progesterone levels never rise and you just have this withdrawal bleed basically. of just getting out the endometrial lining that your body was able to produce with the little bits of estrogen that it had.
Right.
So if you have identified that you ovulated and then 12 to 14 days later, or potentially less, I'll talk about some of the things that can show up in the cycle in just a little bit. But yeah, so some number of days later, a week or two later, then you get a bleed, then you can trust that that was a period. That's your first period. And that's when you start phase two of tracking and charting your cycle. And it's basically the same thing as normal fertility awareness charting, where you're tracking your cervical mucus, your BBT, potentially your cervical position as well, which is an optional sign, but the position and the texture of your cervix changes in the different phases of your cycle. And it will be, so if you've had fertility awareness method training prior to pregnancy, then you might notice that your cervix feels a little bit different. It will always be slightly open after you've given birth. Even if you had a C-section, if you had some amount of time where your cervix was dilating, then it will be a slightly more open than prior to pregnancy. So that's just an interesting aside. But if you don't feel like sticking your fingers in your vagina, I mean, at all, you don't have to do it. And especially after you've given birth, I've only had a vaginal birth, so I don't know if the tenderness is the same with a C-section. I would imagine it's probably different.
I would think it would depend on what led up to it. Like if you were laboring or not, and like, you know, when the C-section happened and how the baby was positioned beforehand. I'm sure that all of that would have a play.
Yeah. But I know that I can't remember exactly how long it was, but I felt very like open and vulnerable and tender for a long time. Not a long time, but for longer than I anticipated. So I wouldn't have probably wanted to be doing cervical position checks at that time. So just to note that that is the full method, and that's what you would be doing in phase two. And so a lot of women notice that in the first few cycles after they've given birth, their cycle will be different from what it was before. Short luteal phase is one of the things that can happen a lot. And that is from sleep deprivation, stress, not eating enough potentially. So the luteal phase is the second half of the cycle after ovulation. And in a healthy cycle, it would be 12 to 14 days, but you can see like, you know, 7, 8, 10 days of that phase potentially. You'll also have a variable cycle length potentially. So if you were somebody that was always like clockwork, you might notice that you'll ovulate a little bit later, earlier. And that's impacted by the things I just listed, like sleep, nutrition. And one other thing I wanted to mention, which I would love to hear your perspective on this too, I think you have two children, right? That you've breastfed. So breastfeeding for me, one of the main things that surprised me about it, my midwives were sort of coaching me through my pregnancy, like to eat more, basically. I had an eating disorder and just had a lot of challenge with being in a pregnant body and just like, what's going to happen? And it actually went a lot better than I thought it was going to based on my history. But then in the postpartum, so yeah, they're sort of like, when you start breastfeeding, you're going to have to eat a shit ton more. So you better get used to it, kind of thing, in a very loving way, not in the way
Of course.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important. And I love to the approach I've seen from you is like the importance of nourishment, but that it's not about like, you know, having a perfect diet even or whatever, but it's about meeting your body's needs for nutrition. And yes, during breastfeeding, you need to eat a lot. A lot of foods.
Yeah. And I have been a vegetarian on and off pretty much since I was a teenager.
Right.
And I'm 37 now. And being a vegetarian does not work for my body anymore. Right. And during pregnancy, I kind of like dabbled in eating meat and I didn't really want to. But since breastfeeding and my daughter's still nursing at almost three, I just really need really good quality nutrition more than ever right now at this time in my life. So prioritizing protein, having a balance of all of the macronutrients and just eating a way, way more than I ever had in my life, which is emotionally and mentally, psychologically really, really hard for me.
Yeah.
So without that background, maybe it wouldn't be so hard for people, but it really surprised me because they're out there. It's like 500 extra calories or something like that. They
yeah,
say.
It's more than you need when you're pregnant for sure. And yeah, it, but, I think it depends. Like, I think it varies it, person to person.
I think so too. I do too. I think it depends on the your nutritional status prior to pregnancy, what you were up to during pregnancy.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, your genetics, like so many things that it would be hard to track. But it really surprised me how much my body needed in order to just like maintain being able to like walk around and think about stuff.
Yeah, I totally understand. And I think that that's like, that's a really good point to bring up. And I'm so careful when I'm talking about nutrition and food, because I don't like, I'm so mindful of eating disorders. And I'm really mindful of what diet culture and even like wellness culture can do to the way that we think about food and our relationship with food and our bodies. And I think it was on your Instagram, I saw, maybe you shared to your stories or something, this quote that was something like, something about needing and appreciating like evidence-based information, but then transitioning to like actually trusting your intuition. And I think that that's like a really beautiful thing. And it, you know, it comes to mind in so many different areas. I was just, for a slight detour, I was listening to a podcast talking about neurodiversity and the neurodiversity movement, and you know how so many of the stakeholders, i.e. autistic and neurodiverse adults, are not being heard. Their stories aren't being heard in the research, the evidence-based research. But then I also think of, not that I want to go down this rabbit trail, but like even like the COVID vaccine and how, you know, there's women saying it's affecting my cycle. And they're like, no, there's no data to show that. But it was because they didn't track it. Nobody tracked it. So I think about this when we even hear like, oh, it's 500 calories like that you need. And it's like, okay, but we like, at a certain point, it's like, that's a great data point to like say as some kind of, you know, like just like to get a sense that it's more, but like so much at the end of the day, it's your intuition and it's your body and it's tuning into that. That is just so, so important. And that, you know, research and the numbers that we come up with and these things, it's good. Like they're not like evil to like, to see that information or whatever, but we have to understand that like, and take it, internalize it alongside of our intuition, you know, like we can't just like look at that as some like, oh, I just have to meet this amount, because I think that that just does so much harm, honestly. So that was my little rant, but
yeah, no, I love that. I really appreciate you sharing that, because, well, and one of the other things, this is kind of more data related, but one of the things that that 500 extra calories doesn't account for is, I don't want to get like, yeah, I don't want to be like, well, you can eat like a bunch, like 500 right. calories of like gummy bears or right. of bone broth and a stew or something. And right. it would be received by your body in a really different way, I guess is what I'm saying. So I'm absolutely. Not trying to demonize well, and somebody, anything.
Right. Of course. And somebody might need that 500 calories in like carbohydrates, like maybe that's what their body is like needing right now. And somebody else might need it in protein, and somebody else might need it in like, you know, avocados or like whatever, right? Like that is that intuitive piece that comes alongside. And none of those data points are really ever going to speak to all of those variables. And you can't, I think we kind of get obsessed with like optimizing our lives through like data and information and just like, oh, just tell me exactly what to do. But that's like so external, right? And we're missing this whole like intrinsic piece of like really knowing ourselves and listening to our bodies. And I truthfully, to bring it all back around, I love that the fertility awareness method facilitates that. And that it's like this point of like coming back to that. And actually, while we're here, I would love for you to just kind of like differentiate what fertility awareness method is versus what a lot of people think about when they think of like natural family, like planning and like maybe like the rhythm method or like these different mm-hmm. things, and how fertility awareness is like encompasses more and is perhaps therefore more reliable or, you know,
totally
better.
Yeah. I appreciate you asking that, because that's such a good thing to differentiate. So the rhythm method, to start with that. So if you talk about fertility awareness in a doctor's office, they're probably going to assume that's what you're talking about.
Right.
And be like, that's bullshit, which it is right, bullshit. Right. So they're right. But basically what that is, it's kind of like a calendar method. So it generally assumes that everybody has a 28-day cycle, which most people don't, and that they always ovulate at day 14, which most people don't.
Exactly.
So if you're somebody that does at this moment in your life, it's possible that your body will not always be that way. So as you get into your 30s, you might notice that your cycle changes if you're in your 20s, for example. And then the same is true once you get into your 40s, like the hormone levels are sort of always shifting, not just based on age, but also our lifestyle and stress and travel and diet and all these different things that if you're not really paying attention to it, you wouldn't necessarily know what to attribute your cycle changes to. But a lot of people think like, oh, my period's late this month, or it came early this month, but it's not really your period that's coming late or early. It kind of depends on when you ovulate. So that can shift and change from month to month. Personally, having tracked my cycle for maybe like 5 or 6 years, really wholeheartedly, I've seen a lot of variability. And my cycle is very sensitive. So I don't think that everybody is like that, but I will say that in the postpartum phase, it can be a little bit more like that, where you're not following this clockwork pattern. Maybe you do, but maybe not right away, for example. And so the rhythm method, if you are using that for birth control, for example, and you kind of have like a buffer, I'm not exactly sure how the rhythm method works. I don't know if you are only supposed to avoid unprotected sex on ovulation day itself, or if they factor in the fact that you are producing cervical mucus prior to that. So the reason that cervical mucus even matters, maybe I haven't mentioned this, but the reason that it matters is because it creates a hospitable environment for sperm. So if you have unprotected sex, say 5 days before ovulation, when your body's producing cervical mucus, you can get pregnant from that 5 day old sperm on ovulation day itself, because your cervical mucus has kept that sperm alive in your cervical crypts, ready to roll on ovulation day, which is super cool. But if you're trying to avoid pregnancy, then not the goal. So I don't know that the rhythm method factors in cervical mucus at all.
It's a calendar, but then you're supposed to like avoid it for like the, whatever, the 5 days before or whatever. Like there is like a week where you kind of avoid sex, but it is purely based. I love that you're like, people think their period's just late or early, but it's so much more complex than that. But I think it highlights the kind of rudimentary knowledge we have of menstruation and of our bodies and just as a whole. And even that the doctors who are like, you know, either family doctors or like an obstetrician or a gynecologist would think that that's the only knowledge that you have of your body and that's the only signs that you are basing things off of. I think that
totally,
it's a whole other topic, but I think it just speaks to the lack of knowledge we have about our bodies.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's no fault of any individual person that doesn't know that. I mean, I know that having gone through eating disorder recovery, my period would go away all the time. Lose my period due to malnutrition. And it was always like, I got to get my period back. Like I got to, if I'm not bleeding, you know, there was never conversation really about ovulation, even amongst my holistic health training. So yeah, it's just really interesting, the gap in knowledge about how women's bodies actually work.
I think that's like, that relates so much to breastfeeding too, right? Like we have more published research on coffee than we do on breast milk. So it's like, you know, it's just, people don't know. And that's when so many doctors, right? Any medication that a person might need to go on, it's like, oh, you can't do that because you're breastfeeding. And it's like, okay, well, let's look. Like we do have, like, let's really think about the way that these things affect it. And it's just like the default, right? In the same sense that like you bring up, you know, fertility awareness method, and the default is like, well, that doesn't work, right? Because there's just this knowledge gap of like, they don't even think about it. It's like, who would spend the time checking their cervical mucus? And yet why not, right? Like, why not understand your body, right? I mean, to consider that people are stepping on the scale extremely regularly as a way to monitor their health, or they believe that that's a good method to monitor their health. And that's a whole other conversation about
don't
whether
do that.
It is or isn't. But that would be much more accepted by a doctor, right? Like, mm-hmm. like, oh, checking your weight very regularly. But then to check these signs that our bodies are giving us that are very readily available to be interpreted, you know, like, why not? Right?
That is such a great correlation. Like, how many people have a scale in their house to assess their health, but don't want to wipe an extra time to check cervical mucus. It's so funny. But it's because we haven't been exposed to this information, you know. But I wanted to go back to natural family planning, which I think, I don't know exactly, it probably depends on the church, but I think natural family planning tends to have a religious connection, and they do tend to get pretty thorough with it.
Yes.
So they're actually pretty great methods. And I don't know exactly what a natural family planning, like what makes it exactly that as distinct from fertility awareness based method. It kind of is a fertility awareness based method in my, what I've learned about it. So, and then there are a lot of different types of fertility awareness-based methods that use different assessment tools. And so the one that I've been trained in is from the Justice School, so from my teacher. She has a business called Fertility Friday, Lisa Hendrickson Jack. She's awesome. And so she teaches the Justice style, which has this like really specific cervical mucus tracking and charting, and then also the BBT and cervical position as part of it. There's other, like the Marquette method also adds in checking like hormone metabolites, and the Billings method, which I think you talked about, is a mucus only method. Yeah. And there's actually a lot of other ones out there too, which those are just the ones I'm thinking of off the top of my head, but there's actually a lot more. So it kind of depends on you and your personality and just what you're exposed to, really. I mean, I found Lisa and was just like, this is great. This is for me. I think that the tracking the metabolites thing sounds interesting too. But I don't think it's really necessary unless there's something that's confusing about these other things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I think that that's great. And I really like what you're saying too, because I am familiar with a number of different ways. Like I'm familiar with the Marquette method. I am familiar with Billings method. But my understanding too was like reaching up in there and checking the mucus, like by actually swiping the cervix. And so I really appreciate that you're like, oh, you just wipe. And I'm like, oh, that sounds so much easier than like, you know, reaching up in there.
So is that Billings that does the internal check?
It is. Yes.
Okay.
And I believe it's like daily, like you're doing, or like very regularly that you're doing internal checking.
Which
I think it was when it kind of threw me off because it was like confusing and it seemed like a lot, and you had to make sure you're getting it from the right spot. And I mean, I could be misinterpreting, but that was what I remember of it. And this was probably like 5 or 6 years ago that I was like looking into it. And it just was like, this is too much.
Well, and that's such a good, I'm glad you brought that up because I know that Lisa in particular said that what she got confused by that method, because it's like, it's wet all the time. You know, like there's always something there. And that's been my experience too. Like it would be way more confusing. And when you do the external checks, it's very obvious. Like when you're in your fertile window, it is very obvious. And the other aspect of that I wanted to touch on is, it just flew out of my head. Oh, if for people that have discomfort with insertion, like vaginismus, vulvodynia.
Yeah. Or even just sexual trauma from like the, like, you know, maybe it's just like an emotionally uncomfortable thing or like.
Yeah. I mean, like they have applicators on tampons so that we never have to touch our vulva or our vagina.
Right.
And I mean, a lot of women are so removed from that area. And I mean, that's problematic for sure. And there needs to be sort of like a bridge to get people into being able to be more comfortable with their body fluids and things that are happening in their system. That's not necessarily, you know, probably some people are just like, yeah, cool. I'll just stick my finger in my vagina. No problem. Like that's personally how I feel about it. But I know that there were other times in my life where I did not feel that way. And I did struggle with vaginismus and know that I would not have wanted to be doing any kind of, cervical checks at that time, for sure.
Yeah, I think it makes so much sense. And I mean, even as I'm sitting here, I think about how, like, on one hand, it's like, ooh, like body fluids, that's like gross, but we monitor ourselves all the time. Like, it's like, oh, like you have a cold, like, oh, what color is the mucus coming out of your nose? Like, that's something that you check by, like bowel movements. Like, we're, even though it's gross or like, you know, whatever, we know that that's like important to watch. Like we just intrinsically, like we were raised that way, right? Like you just know that these are the things you pay attention to. And yet it's so strange to me that like our cervical mucus and the fluids, like our vaginal fluids and whatnot, that we feel this far removed from it. And that it is something that's like, you know, like, oh, why would I want to touch that? Or why would I want to look at that? And I think that that's like, I so appreciate, and like, if that's coming up for anyone listening, like those kinds of feelings, like, I think that that's so valid and that's like, okay, and it's not your fault. But I do think that that's like just such an interesting thought of like, where are we at in society that we feel that far removed? Just, you know, like growing up, you know, and in being a woman or like being, you know, in this body that has a vagina and has a cervix, and yet I don't want to think about it or I don't want to touch it. And that is something that we, you know, I think many people feel.
Totally. I think that it's changing now, but I'm also so in this world that I know, it's just the people that I talk to. Like everybody thinks cervical mucus is awesome.
I totally, yeah. I get that so much too. Sometimes I forget how much I am in my own space with people. And then I say things and I'm like, oh, whoops, sorry. I didn't realize that this was as inappropriate to say in this context for all of you. It didn't feel totally, inappropriate or even to me at all.
To go back to breastfeeding too, like I saw a woman, I don't know where you stand on this, but I saw a woman breastfeeding, I don't remember exactly where it went, but like in a store, and she had like a cover thing like over her baby. And I mean, I was a little bit spoiled maybe in like a weird way that my daughter was born like pretty much when COVID started. So I spent a ton of time at home, but I never had anything like covering her. And I was just like, you're suffocating your baby. So like, so some old man can like not be uncomfortable by seeing your nipple or something. I don't know. It just, yeah, I think about breastfeeding too. And like how lucky I feel that nobody has really ever said anything to me about it, but like what bullshit it would be if they did, you know? Right.
Oh, absolutely. I hear you. And I mean, yeah, as far as like, I used them with my daughter when I felt like it was what I needed to do. And I was still trying to figure it out. But then I remember the first time I breastfed her, like uncovered in public. And I was like, this is so freeing. I was like, oh, yeah, that's amazing. And it is still jarring to see people covering. And yet I get it. And I was there, but like in public, because to me, part of it is the fact that I sit in mom's homes. And I mean, they're just like, I'm just looking at boobs all day long. And like, you know, like it's just so normal. So then I see them covered in public and no judgment, but it is like a little bit of startling, like, oh, you still feel like you have to do that. And I get it. And if you want to do that, that is like 1000%, like that is cool. You do you, like zero, but it is still like, oh yeah, like that is the world we live in where like that's still the norm and expected. And I'm in my own space that I forget.
Totally. Yeah. And yeah, no shade on anybody that does that. It's definitely, I would have a hard time with it if somebody said something to me like, oh, you're gross. Or like, that would be uncomfortable. And I'm not like calling that in, you know? So right. I understand if you're somebody that is out and about maybe more than I am. Right. And you need to do that.
Yeah. It's everyone's, I think it's comfort with your own body. There's so many factors because I know moms that I work with, like they will feel the need to cover in their own home because a window might be open or because, you know, somebody might come in. And I so understand, like, I get that. There's no judgment at all. And I know that I once was there too. And so I think that that's it I forget there's a word for it that you can't remember what things were like once you've been through, like once you've kind of come to the other side, that it can be very hard to put yourselves back in that shoes. And I still experience that where it's like, oh, I forget that that's what it was like. Like, I don't, you know, like I've kind of moved through such a long journey since then that, yeah. It's
Different. Yeah, totally.
I feel like we should probably wrap up. I could talk for easily another hour, but I would just love to hear, you know, maybe if you could just give like a little bit of encouragement to, especially as you are breastfeeding your almost 3-year-old and having walked this journey of reconnecting with yourself and even through, you know, eating disorders and then learning your body and all of that. What encouragement would you give to the mom who is kind of like listening to this podcast and feeling a little overwhelmed and discouraged in mom life?
Yeah.
What would be something you would share for that with them?
Well, one of the things that's been really helpful for me that I didn't make this up, but that I've heard from other people is that mothering is like the, to me, feels like the highest spiritual calling.
Yeah.
And that your baby chooses you intentionally to be their mother. And that means a lot to me because there's been a lot of times throughout my limited experience of mothering where I doubt myself. Or, you know, especially with nursing, because my now ex-husband was very rude about me continuing to nurse and had opinions about me stopping, and especially related to like our sexuality and my desire to return to that, being related to me wanting to continue breastfeeding. But I would just say that, to go back to your baby choosing you, they chose you because they wanted the journey that you're going to offer them, and you know what's best for your baby. So you can read all the stuff on Instagram and blogs and books, and you can talk to lots of other moms. You can talk to family members, partners. But I really think that mommies know the best.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much for being here, Holly. It was such a pleasure. And I cannot wait to have you on again, because I feel like there's so many more things we can talk about.
Totally. I agree. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome.
If you loved this episode, make sure you hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss any episodes in the future. Also, check out my breastfeeding toddler communication guide and cheat sheet to learn how to say no to the feed while still saying yes to the need at www.ownyourparentingstory.com/guide. And that concludes another episode of Start to Stop Toddler Breastfeeding. The theme song is Little Balloon by Jenny and Tyler, and it has been a pleasure to share this time with you. I'll catch you in the next episode.